And welcome to Shattered Lives, a lively, educational, and issues-driven radio show designed to tell another side of the story, to focus on and humanize crime victims, to enlighten and shine the spotlight on organizations and service providers, and to assist those who walk the path with us. This is Donna R. Gore, a.k.a. Lady Justice, your host, with my co-host, Delilah Jones, president of Imagine Publicity.com, welcoming you this evening and every Saturday evening to shine the light on a special guest with the focus on the aftermath of crime. And this evening we have a very special treat in that we are featuring someone I met from last year's Nova conference, and a colleague of our very good friend, Will Marlings, and he happens to be a police chief. And we're going to be talking about, some people term domestic violence, but we like to say intimate partner violence because we feel it's more descriptive. And hopefully Susan Murphy Milano will be listening from heaven, because this is her kind of show. And so I'm very delighted to have Chief Larry Reinhardt on. But before we bring him on formally, I want to say good evening, Delilah. We've got the two Ds, and Larry Reinhardt. How are you?
I'm doing great. You have another very, very important and interesting show planned for this evening. It's always listeners always need to be reminded about intimate partner violence and domestic violence and how it's perpetrated, how it can be prevented, and what victims need to do if they're caught up in a situation that they just can't get out of. So I'm very interested to welcome our guest and get on with the show.
Sure. And just to say, one size does not fit all. So if Larry has some methods of his own that have been effective, all the better. So just let me tell you very briefly a little biographical sketch. Larry Reinhardt served for 12 years in the Ohio National Guard. He has a lot of training with respect to aviation maintenance. He was in the Army Band, the Ohio Military Academy. His introduction into the police was in a smaller town called Ghana, and he served in many capacities: a SWAT officer, a bicycle officer, a patrol sergeant, public information officer, and deputy chief. And then he found his current position as of April 2007 as the chief police of the city of Bexley, which is in central Ohio, is my understanding. And within that time, he also became a victim of intimate partner violence because his sister, Laura, tragically lost her life. And that is what we are going to focus on. And for us to have the window of opportunity to hear this with respect to someone who is in law enforcement as well and be a victim, I think, is a prime opportunity. So, Chief Larry, thank you so much for being with us. It's a pleasure to have you this evening on Shattered Lives.
Well, thank you. The pleasure is mine, and Donna and Delilah, I certainly appreciate the opportunity to speak to you tonight.
Well, it's our pleasure to have you and to give you a national voice for this very important information and important topic. Hopefully I did you justice in my introduction with regard to your background, but I wondered, you are also the author of two books. You have one that deals with domestic violence, and another from your other background as well. But I wondered if would you like to begin by telling us what transpired with your sister, and then we can get into some other topics.
Well, my sister, Laura, was a couple years older than me. She had she had had a few rough marriages, and my sister was a great lady, and I'm always cautious when I tell her story to not ever give the impression that she was anything less than that. But her life was a little bit rough. We came from a small village in southern Ohio, and her life was a little bit rough. It was a little bit rough as we were growing up. We had a little violence in our life. And anyway, my sister, I think my sister escaped a lot of things when she was 16, when she married her first husband. And, of course, they had a child together. My sister dropped out of school. And you know, I see so many young people go down that same path today, and I try to talk to them and say, you know, it's such a rough path. Stay in school, you know, get your high school diploma. But sometimes they don't. And my sister didn't, and she had a couple failed marriages, and she had two daughters from her second marriage, Lindsay and Elizabeth. They were 14 and 16 when my sister was murdered. But Lindsay and Elizabeth and their mother lived with my sister's third husband. Mm-hmm. And her behavior, my sister's behavior, I don't know how to characterize it, but it was a little crazy for us because she was never around. We didn't see much of her. Some of the things she did didn't make sense. We found out later, of course, much after the fact, that a lot of that was because she had married a guy who was very much a controller. I mean, he was a textbook controller. The point, you know, you've heard these stories before. This was the guy that when my sister went to the grocery store and came home, he would check the receipt to see what time she checked out.
And this was the third husband, you're saying, that she married? And when did she marry him? What kind of a time frame or year did this happen, Larry?
You know, I don't know what year they were married because they had been married for several years before the murder. And I don't know. I never thought to do the math and figure that out. But I think they had probably been married. Shoot, they may have been married 8 or 10 years. So we all, the family... And this is something, when I give my presentations to people, and I've had a great opportunity to speak to many, many groups of all sizes, but my family had kind of distanced ourselves from Laura because we just didn't know what was going on with her. Some of her behavior seemed a little crazy to us. So this guy talked her to moving into backwoods Alabama. And, you know, my sister came, she spent a lot of her life in and around Columbus in a pretty urban environment. Mm-hmm. But he had talked her into moving into backwoods Alabama. And when I was down there, when this whole thing happened, I was down there and I saw where they lived and I thought, holy cow, you were out in the sticks. Your nearest neighbor was miles away. But he had done that intentionally,
isolate
you know, as
her.
A controller. Yes, to completely mm-hmm. isolate her. He'd been very successful at that. Now, he was on some form of disability. I mean, the guy was just a bum. He was on disability. And he had decided he wasn't going to try and work because he was going to be a professional gambler. I'm telling you, I have had the opportunity to tell thousands of schoolgirls that if you're ever dating a guy or ever married to a guy who says he's going to be a professional gambler, to run away from that guy. Because in my mind, professional gambler is often synonymous with loser.
Well, if they're in the backwoods, Larry, in this little place in the woods, where would he even have the opportunity to gamble? Or are you talking about online or something?
I don't think that they were active online. I don't know. Honestly, I don't know where his game was. But
it's not like
finally,
there was a casino next door, right?
Right, right. And I don't think they even had internet access. I mean, my sister, she worked and kind of kept the whole family afloat. I mean, she was a hard worker. She was a hard worker. But she finally, the great irony of this is, and I guess it's not ironic because a lot of specialists in this area tell me it's typical of controllers that they're at their worst when they think they're losing control. My sister had actually went back to school, got her GED, and, you know, that's hard to do, especially when you have kids. But my sister had done that. And my sister had also got some medical certification to work in a small doctor's office. So she was employed, she was making an income, she was really taking care of her two daughters, and they were 14 and 16 at the time. Mm-hmm. And, of course, I'm talking about 2001, so that's been a while ago. But they were 14 and 16 at the time. And my sister really had some things going on for herself. So she realized, hey, I've been married to this guy for a long time. He is just a drain on us. There's certainly no love in the relationship. He just, you know, he's just a bad guy. So finally she moved out of the house and said, hey, I'm not going to be married to you anymore. You're really ruining my life and my daughter's life. So
she
booted him out.
Did she announce her plans, Larry, before she left? Did she announce her plans to him before she left?
Well, she didn't leave. She called the sheriff and had him removed from the house. And, you know, that took great courage, I think.
Yes.
You know, that took great courage. But she knew, she had told some friends down there that she feared for herself because she just was fearful of what this guy might be capable of. Now, you know, we never saw that. When they were here in Ohio, he was an older fella. He was older than my sister. And he seemed very meek and mild and quiet. But in my research after my sister's death, I've come to find that's not uncommon. Often controllers, when they're around other groups of people and around family and around other men, are meek and quiet. But it's only when they have their victim isolated that they become empowered. And that's that's what happened. That's what he did. But ironically, my sister she was really getting her life together. She had worked hard and booted him out of the house. And you know, that guy, when he knew he had lost control, that's when that guy went, borrowed a firearm from his sister, or from his brother, I'm sorry. The evening of May the 11th of 2001, he came back, parked his truck away from the house, walked to the house, and you could always tell where he had been because he smoked these cigarettes. He didn't have any filters on them. And it's almost like that's where he derived his courage from. The sheriff showed me where the first pile of cigarettes was when my sister's abuser stood outside the house, built his courage up on the evening of May the 11th, walked over to the house, and pulled the telephone line out of the house. And then he left. And that's pretty doggone premeditated, if you ask me.
Right.
And then he came back the next morning. He came back at probably about 8 o'clock, maybe about 8:30 in the morning. And there's another little pile of cigarettes where he built his courage up. He had the handgun by then. And he walked up to the door and kicked the door in. And I tell people, you know, you really need to reinforce your deadbolt. It might give you a little early warning time. I don't know if it would help my sister. But he kicked the door in. My sister was running the vacuum. She's cleaning house. He raised the handgun up and shot her right in the midsection of her body, and she fell to the floor. And either the gunshot or the kick on the door woke my two nieces up, Lindsay and Elizabeth. And they came, and they stood at the door. They stood in the hallway. I don't think it was 15 feet away. And they watched as he shot their mother two more times, killing her. Turned the gun around, pointed it at my two nieces, and by the grace of God alone, he lowered the gun and ran out of the door and fled. So those girls, I'm so proud of both of them, because
what
you know,
did they do?
Well, one of them got in a car and drove to the neighbor. I mean, their mother's literally in a pool of blood, bleeding out, dying on the floor, drove to the nearest neighbor and said, you know, my stepdad just shot my mom. Please send help. Please help me. She was so emotional she couldn't drive back. She walked back. So when the police got there, they had found her walking back towards the house. And that incredible trauma, I'm so proud. Now, those girls still deal with that every day. And they certainly deal with it on their mother's birthday and the anniversary of her death and all those key milestones in a young lady's life when their mother is there. And, of course, their mother's not. You know, when they were married and when they had children, and they both have children. And but they, in spite of carrying that incredible burden with them through this life, they both stand tall and they both have done very well. And I'm exceptionally proud of them. They're both just wonderful, amazing people, I think.
Yeah, and are they doing something special with regard to her memory? you know, carrying on a legacy with regard to, you know, trying to assist other victims, or do they, you know, do they make presentations themselves? Do you know? Do you keep up with your nieces?
Well, I keep up with Lindsay more than Elizabeth. I know Elizabeth doesn't live far from here. She's got a family and has a couple babies now, and she's doing very well. But she actually became a nurse, and which is calling unto itself. And I think maybe that is part of how she
to get back.
Lindsay just had a wonderful baby son, and she's doing incredibly well. She's talked to me a few times about maybe becoming involved in social services. She's very in tune to wanting to help other people. She's a very smart young lady, has done very, very well. And I'm confident that she, because she's seeking her niche, and she's aware of what she wants to do, and I'm very confident that soon she will lock in to that, because she wants to use her pain and that suffering to help others. And I have no doubt that she will. So that's a blessing. It's so much a blessing
that
the two. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm very proud of them.
I'm wondering also with two other aspects of the story. Can you tell us a bit about after the perpetrator, shot her and fled, what happened with him? And then can you go into a little bit about the investigation and was he caught or and the consequences and those kinds of things?
Well, yes. It was in Bibb County, Alabama, and the Bibb County Sheriff is like so many rural sheriff departments. They try to do a lot with very limited resources. And I met several investigators down there and even the sheriff. And with their limited resources, they tried to do all they could do, but they knew he was on the run, and there were a lot of people in the community that were fearful that he would come back. So the sheriff department had to deploy a lot of their resources just to protect those who remained behind. At the time, I was a deputy chief of police in Gahanna, and we had received he had said something to somebody. I don't remember now exactly how this happened, but he had said that he knew I was a police officer and that he might just have to come back up here and try to dispose of me. Well, that was enough for my chief at the time, Chief Dennis Murphy. That was enough for him to say, okay, we are stepping into this investigation. I'm not going to have a killer running loose, you know, making threats against one of my officers. Fortunately for us, the killer, he went across state lines. He went down to Florida. And once that happens, the FBI lends a lot of resources to that type of a murder investigation once he had fled state lines. And we were able to prove that he did.
Wow.
Our detective bureau at the time, it's pronounced Gahanna.
If you can say banana,
you can say Gahanna. But you made the same, and a lot of people make that error in pronouncing it. But it's Gahanna. And it's a pretty thriving suburban community not far from here. About 35,000 people live there, and it's a pretty good community. Police department is an excellent police department. And one of the detectives, Detective Jeff Spence, that guy, he started communicating with the Bibb County Sheriff Department and the FBI and started trying to track where this killer had went. Last we knew, he was in Florida. Well, Detective Spence had uncovered the fact that 20 years ago, the killer had a girlfriend in a surrounding community outside of Gahanna, actually Pickerington, which is another little town. But that the killer had a relationship and had an old girlfriend. I mean, it's just like a TV show. Only he wasn't able to wrap it up in 25 minutes, but he did a pretty good job. Lieutenant Spence actually went over to this girlfriend's house, knocked on the door, I said, hey, this is a long shot. We're just wondering if you've heard from this guy. And she was pretty cool and calm and collected. Said, no, I haven't heard from him in 20 years. Well, as it turned out, he was in the house right behind the door when Lieutenant Spence was knocked. Do you believe that? Up here in Central Ohio is where he'd hold up at this old girlfriend's house. And it scared him so bad that when Lieutenant Spence left, It scared the murderer so bad that he got in his car and drove to the Pickerington Police Department, turned himself in. Because he had...
Really?
He was mistaken. He thought that if Gehenna got a hold of him, my police department got a hold of him, that we would do him harm. And of course, we wouldn't have. I mean, they follow the letter of the law. They wanted to bring him to justice. But he went to Pickerington and turned himself in. So we transported him, got him on an airplane, got him back to Alabama. And, you know, as you know, in this business, unfortunately, it's not a perfect world. The justice system is not always just.
Right.
And police officers and social workers know that better than anybody. But he didn't get the death sentence in Alabama, but he got life in prison with possibility of parole in 2016. And, I mean, it was clear cut. He killed her. There were witnesses he killed her. There was no disputing the murder, no disputing the fact that he fled. It was a clear cut. If anybody should have ever been in prison for the rest of their life, it's this guy. But unfortunately, in 2016 now, which is right around the corner.
He got a year and a half, yes.
Yeah, we're going to have to go down there and argue with the parole board, please don't let him out. Because, you know, when it's been several years now, but when he was in prison in Alabama, he actually got a hold of a cell phone and called one of the daughters and harassed her a little bit from prison. It's incredible that can happen, but it does happen. I mean... The victimization just doesn't seem to ever end, you know?
No, it doesn't. And you know what I want to ask? Delilah, have you ever heard from all of the cases that you and Susan had discussed on air or off air where the perpetrator was right there and actually got scared and gave themselves up like that? Have you heard of that before?
Yeah, you know, the thing, and I'm sure Larry can verify, that these abusers do all kind of crazy things. And so it's not a surprise. And they were lucky that they were able to track him to that place. They were able to get the sense to go to it. And, you know, one thing that Susan and I discovered working missing persons cases and domestic violence cases as well is most of the time these abusers go where they know. If they've hidden a body, they usually hid it somewhere where they think is a secret because it's familiar to them. And we found that to be the case over and over and over again. Wouldn't you say, have you run into that as well, Larry?
Yes, you're exactly right. They do go to where, and they go back to what they're familiar with. And this is a perfect case of that. 20 years ago,
absolutely.
A girlfriend, 20 years ago. And
yeah.
He gravitates back to that.
Wow.
But you're exactly right. You know, at one point, I always tried to sing the praises of some small-town police officers and detectives. You know, sometimes we think, well, these guys are kind of podunk, and they're really not like investigators on big agencies, and they're just not as well-trained and not as smart. But I'll tell you, my experience has been, even here in Bexley and in Gehenna, certainly, those investigators – those people are invested. They do incredible work. And like you were saying, they know. They know where to go and where to look, that past behavior, those past places. I would stack up my detective bureau, certainly the Gehenna Detective Bureau, against any organization. They solve crimes every day without any fanfare. And certainly I've told Lieutenant Spence this time and time again, I'm indebted to him. I'm indebted to the guy. He went the extra mile and did what you just said. He took the time to figure out where those old places, those old haunts were, and that's how he brought him to justice. You know, let me add this in.
Go ahead.
These folks in Alabama were still holed up, and they were still, including my two nieces, were still down there. And they were holed up, and they were scared, and they were all kind of together in a house. And I had the pleasure, and it still gives me chills to speak of this. I had the pleasure of picking up the phone and calling down there to where all these people were in his house. And I had the pleasure of saying, we've got him. He's in custody right now. And the room lit up in cheers. I mean, because folks really feared him. They thought, this guy's going to come back.
So did you notify your nieces? Did you have that pleasure?
That's who was in the room. In fact, that's who I called. Yeah, they answered the phone, and that's who I called, and I said, we've got him. He's in custody. And, I mean, it was It was really that will always be one of the high points.
Wow.
Yeah, one of my career, my police career, that is a high point. Now, fortunately for my nieces, their father, the second, my sister's second marriage, their father, is a great guy. I've known him for years. He still lives here in Columbus. In fact, he's a mailman. He's a postal deliverer here in Columbus, and he's a great guy. He got in the car and drove down and took custody of his two daughters and brought them back up here. Mm-hmm. And his new wife, mm-hmm. they had suffered loss. They had had a child. I die of a disease not long before then. And they were already hurting and suffering. They brought those two girls into their house and took them under their wing and took really good care of those girls and made sure they were taken care of. And I just, sometimes it's hard for me to even imagine how much trauma, pain, and suffering there was in that house at the same time. But they got through it.
Undoubtedly. And I also was curious about, you didn't relate, although maybe there was, but maybe on the positive side there wasn't. We always wonder about jurisdictional issues and sort of the infighting and lack of cooperation. You had Alabama, you had FBI, and you had law enforcement from Ohio, right? All of the three entities working together cooperatively, collaborating and sharing, is that right?
Right, that's correct. And I attribute that a lot to the Gahanna Police Department. Those detectives were very respectful. You know, they were very careful that when they talked to the Bibb County Sheriff Department, they were respectful to them. They were respectful. You know, we treat them with respect. We didn't try to diminish their role. I mean, I understand that a lot of law enforcement agencies are staffed with great people with very minimal resources. And at the time, I felt that was the case with Bibb County. You know, they used to have a lot of dollars. It's not an affluent area. And my hat is always off to county sheriffs all over this country and sheriff departments who continue to do the job when they have limited dollars, limited resources. They can't pay police officers very much. They don't always have the best equipment. But by golly, they're dedicated, and they work as hard as they possibly can. And we treated them that way. We treated them with respect. And, of course, the FBI, our experience up here has always been the FBI leadership in our area has always just been incredible. They're always glad to work with other professionals, and they don't care if you're from a 15-member police department or a 200-member police department. They don't care. They'll help. They'll work with you. So, yeah, we were very fortunate there. We had good relationships.
That's wonderful. It's such a nice change of pace to hear. With respect to prior to your sister making plans to leave or, you know, kicking him out, to your knowledge in the aftermath, did you locate or hear of a specific safety plan that she had in place?
No, I don't think there was.
No.
I don't think there was anything like that. She talked to people at work, and she said, you know, this, I'm just afraid that he's going to hurt me. She would come out on her break, and my sister smoked cigarettes. She would come out on her break and smoke a cigarette outside the building and look a block down across the street, and there he would stand watching her. She knew, you know, and that's another thing, unsung, unfunded heroes are our social services. Now, you know, here in Columbus, we have a great social services network, many organizations, many philanthropic organizations that help fund the nonprofits. But, you know, it's just not that way when you get into less populated areas, less prosperous areas. And I don't think, I mean, there were no strong organizations that my sister could reach out to in Bibb County. I'm sure they're dedicated professionals, but there are a few of them. They're overworked, they're overburdened, and underfunded. I mean, it's just not, you know, funding domestic violence and relationship violence organizations, I have found this out firsthand. Giving your dollars to them is just always not a sexy thing to do. You know, people will give money to whatever the big nonprofit of the week is and whatever gets the most press, you know, on television, but they often won't give a lot of money to domestic violence nonprofit because it's just not sexy. It's not, and they don't have the dollars to advertise on TV and on the radio. It's a tough business. It's a tough business.
Right. And people don't realize that they think, oh, well, they might get a bruise or a slap, but they don't die. And they do. They die in great, great numbers, just as if you had cancer or something. And that's what the general public who has no experience with this doesn't even realize, I think. You know, and that's another, where you get the good money. Go ahead, Delilah.
Another aspect to that is that not all of effective advocates work for an agency, nor do they, you know, get funded or paid by an agency.
Right.
There's a lot of advocates out there who do wonderful hands-on, you know, effective work, keeping people alive that are never recognized for the work that they've done, and they've never been paid for the work that they've done.
That's exactly right. And they spend their own money. They spend their own money, their own time, their own resources. They take great risk sometimes, and they're just called to do that. You're right. They are unsung heroes, and you don't even know they're amongst us sometimes, you know?
Well, we know of many, many people. You know, Susan Merson Milano was one of them, the great, great organization that we're affiliated with, the Q Center for the Missing. I mean, they operate on all, you know, volunteerism. And the list could go on and on, but you are so right about that. You know, if you were there in Alabama, Larry, with her during that time before this happened, in hindsight, knowing that there's a lack of resources and they're in this backwater town, and I don't know what kind of disability this guy had. He sounded pretty agile to me, unless it was psychiatric disability, and that's my former medical training coming out. But anyway, what do you think could have been done differently in this scenario, if there was anything?
Well, you know, that's a good question, because I'll tell you, I've thought a lot about that, and we all bear a lot of guilt for that, because so often when somebody gets into a dysfunctional, dangerous, abusive relationship, their behavior seems a little crazy, and that's what we thought about my sister. So we all kind of backed away from her a little bit, and when she moved to Alabama, we were just content to let her go to Alabama, and we didn't have much to do with her. And we thought, because she didn't reach out to us much, she didn't want to have a lot to do with us.
Right.
The family thought that. And the family always thought, well, she'll come back around. She'll come back around someday. That's what you think, because you don't realize that she's under the thumb of an abusive controller. You don't realize that. And I tell people, when people call me, I get calls all the time from all over the state. People call and say, you know, my niece or somebody that I know is in an abusive relationship. What should I do? The first thing I say is, don't give up on them. Keep talking to them. Keep talking to them, even when their behavior seems to be irrational. You know, we know the statistic is that an abused victim will often go back to the abuser 7 times before they finally break away for free. And I tell people that. I said, don't give up on them, because we kind of gave up on Laura, and we just thought she would come back around. What I would do differently, whether I was in Alabama or if I were up here, I would have stayed in contact with my sister. I should have done that. I mean, my life was pretty busy. I have a ton of excuses, but none of them are good enough. I should have stayed in contact with my sister on the telephone. I should have been talking to her, because if I would have been able to do that, I think maybe she would have said to me, hey, I'm divorcing this guy. I'm kicking him out of the house, but I'm afraid of him. Because at some point I probably would have said, hey, if you can't find a safe haven down there, you pack your 2 daughters up and you come back to Ohio. Do it in the middle of the night in a cloak of darkness. And I would have let her know you have that option. Make that your escape plan. Throw your stuff in the car and flee and come back up here, and your family will get you set up again. I mean, she could have got a job up here, but she didn't have anybody up here telling her that. She probably felt that she was completely isolated. She probably felt, well, my family doesn't give a darn about me. She probably thought that.
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't reach out. And so often I see that, especially when young people get in bad relationships, young women they get in bad relationships with bad guys, and they move in with them, and maybe they have a baby or two. And sometimes I see families just get mad and say, well, you were raised better than that. You should have never done that. And
you forget it. We're going to fight you up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
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 That is so true.
And I tell people, don't do that. Don't write them off. Stay in touch with them. No matter how hard it is, stay in their lives. Because they may need that safety net. They may need somebody that they can tell, hey, I fear for my life. My sister had told people that she worked with. She had told people that she worked with it. She feared that someday he would kill her. Now, people take that.
And those people, Larry, did they? It sounds as if they didn't. It sounds as if they just kind of kept it to themselves. They didn't share with other people, these coworkers, right? Maybe they had their own problems.
Yeah, maybe they did. And I don't know if they would know who to share that with, honestly.
Right.
I'd say we're my sister's friend, but I don't know if they knew who to share that with. What do you do with that kind of information? You're in a backwater, little community, limited law enforcement, limited social support, social worker support. What do you do? Who do you tell that to? You know, and you're right. I'm sure they had their own problems, their own family issues, you know, struggling, trying to make ends meet. But they were heartbroken. I mean, they were truly, truly heartbroken, as were we. I mean, my mother has since passed away, but I went down there. My mother called me. I think it was 8:50 in the morning, the day my sister was killed. My mother called me, and I think that might have even been in 2001. I think that might have even been Mother's Day. It was either Mother's Day or the day before Mother's Day.
Wow.
And my mom had to call me and tell me that my sister had just been shot and murdered.
Your mother had to do that? Wow.
Yeah, because
it's
they
incredible.
Called mom. Somebody down there called mom. And you know, I'll never forget that. I'll never forget just that quick. It takes a while for that to set in. It took.
Well, it really does. I'm not trying to do. Can you top this one? But in order for us to be notified about my father's homicide, we actually read about an article in the paper and had to call the Hartford police and say, is this the person that was, you know, missing? And so we actually had to call and ask the police. So Larry, that's awful too. So, you know, I share in your very, you know, the feelings that it conjures up, those things will, those scenarios, those pictures will never leave our mind. To have your mother have to call you and tell you that information, it's just absolutely awful, unconscionable, whatever. You know, I totally agree with that. And what I wanted to ask you, we have like 21 minutes or so. You are a very, very good speaker, and this is going very, you know, very swiftly. I really am very impressed with your story and your commitment. But wanted to know about, when did you think about writing a book, or even to try to help people? And how was that juxtaposed with your law enforcement career? Are you there? Hello?
There we go.
Can you hear me now?
Oh, now I can.
Did you hear my question?
Sorry,
yes,
I
did.
Don't know what happened there. Okay.
I did hear your question.
Okay.
Technology is not always perfect, is it?
No, it's not.
But,
no, it's not.
You know, I actually, sometime later, it might have been October in 2001, I've been a public speaker in law enforcement, and I was a public speaker when I was in the military.
Yeah.
But I hadn't thought much about telling this story. But Linda Shannon, who's a school teacher, she was a high school teacher at Gehanna Lincoln High School. She talked me into coming over and giving a presentation to her health class, because Linda saw the relationship between young men and young women, and she saw things that concerned her, and she said, you know, I need someone to come over here and tell these young girls that when they go down this path, it can be very dangerous. And I said, Linda, I don't know if I'm the guy to do that. But anyway, she talked me into doing it. I went over, and the first presentations were horrible. I broke out in a sweat. I just, it was hard for me to get my presentation. But they were they were a great hit. I did that for Linda for many years. I go talk to every one of her health students. And over the years, giving that presentation, I started to become popular with a lot of different organizations. I'll tell you who I became popular with as a public speaker were some of these small outlying nonprofits that don't have any budget. They really liked me to come and speak because I never charged any money. And I was glad to do that. And I had a message, and they were appreciative. So I was able to do that. I spoke to church groups of all sizes. And along the way, I started thinking, you know, I've amassed a lot of knowledge about this thing, about relationship violence. I've amassed a lot of knowledge. I think I have some things to share. And I thought, you know, I'm going to write a book. And I had I've been through, you know, I have a master's degree, and that had went to my head. And I thought, I ought to be a good writer. I got a master's degree. I'm going to write this book. And in my mind, I thought, this is going to be a really thick book, and it's going to be great. And it's going to be all about relationship violence. And I had a vision. Now, this is no kidding. You're going to think I'm goofy when I tell you this. But I had a vision of me sitting on Oprah's couch, talking to Oprah about my book about relationship violence. So I had a mission. I had all my materials. I set my material by the computer. I had everything ready to write. I sat down, and I wrote about 15 pages and realized that I had actually written every single thing I know about this topic. So I actually made it into a little pamphlet at first, and I had some nonprofits donate money and help me get it printed, and I gave it away. And I did that for quite a while. And then I wrote another one, and ultimately I wrote like three of these pamphlets. Well, my wife is an amazing publisher. I mean, she's an artist. She's a publisher. She's such a blessing to me. Oh, my goodness, this woman does everything. And she said, listen, let me turn that into a book for you. Let me do some artwork and turn it into a book. I'll make it flow. We'll put it together. We'll update the material. She actually did all the heavy lifting of turning it into a real publication and into a book, and it's been available on Amazon for quite a while. She just had it put in Kindle format. I think I've over the year or two that it's been available, I think I've made about $15. Still haven't made it to Oprah's couch, but that's what led me to write a book.
So. Brian.
So I have that out of my system, wanting to write a book. I actually wrote another book about leadership, the leadership vision, and it did equally as well. So anyway, I spent more money in buying these books myself in bulk and giving them away.
Oh, we know that story. Yes.
Yeah.
Well, I always tell people.
Go ahead, Delilah.
I always tell people that it's not, you know, if you're going to make a living writing books, it's a long haul. There's not too many out there that can actually do that without, you know, somebody in the background that helps them financially.
Yeah.
Well, and you know that I feel in my life and my belief system, I feel that this is all God directed. I mean, that's my faith and that's what I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if the Lord wanted me to be a wealthy author, then I would be. But I'm very blessed, and I'm very glad to be a police chief who writes as a hobby.
Well, see, that works out fine. What are the main principles of what is in the content of your now much improved book, thanks to your wife? What are the main principles that you tell people when you do a presentation about domestic violence or intimate partner violence prevention, Larry?
Well, in my book, I speak a lot about how the things that we're exposed to as we grow up, whatever environment we're in when we grow up, how that affects us, how that affects our subconscious view of what's acceptable and what's not acceptable. And it's been my observation that sometimes young people are subjected, especially young women, are subjected to some level of emotional or even physical abuse as they grow up. Or sometimes young women get into relationships with men over long, long periods of time where they're subjected to either emotional or physical abuse. And that kind of becomes, subconsciously, becomes your acceptable normal. as much as you hate it, and as much as you know you don't need that in your life, you know, we all know women that go from destructive relationship to destructive relationship. And I think that's because subconsciously that's kind of the way they've been programmed. And I tell young women, you can overcome that. You just have to understand it. You have to look at your past life and past relationships and identify those things that weren't good, that you don't want in your life anymore, and you need to be aware of them and purge them from yourself. But if you don't address it, I believe you're prone to find yourself back in those same relationships. All of us know
right.
young women who were in bad relationships, and they finally escape it. And you say, thank God they got out of that horrible relationship. And the next thing you know, they're with another guy who's just as bad. And you think, how in the world do you go from bad to bad to bad? And I think it's because of the way we're programmed. Now, that's part of my presentation.
Well,
but
that's
I, of
a
course,
good
I,
point. Yeah.
I always try to conclude my presentation with two main points. First, I talk to the young men. And I say, you know, fellas, if let me define stalking to you. Let me tell you what's not acceptable. Let me tell you what bad behavior looks like. The boy who breaks up with a girl, or she breaks up with him, and then he texts her, sends her text messages, like 500 text messages over the next 2 weeks, that's abusive behavior. A lot of young men don't connect the dots. That's abusive behavior. Yeah. And I knew a young lady. I was in a situation like that where a young lady, her father came over to me and said, hey, you know, she broke up with this guy, and he's texting her all the time. She goes out with her new boyfriend. Her old boyfriend texts her and tells her that he saw them at the restaurant. He's stalking her. And that is so
right.
textbook. And I tell young women, I tell young men, don't do it. Don't do it. If a girl says no and she doesn't want you to be your girlfriend, get away from her. Leave her alone. Don't do it. And I talk to young men about our inner rage. And this is a story. I don't know if any of my material, if I created any of it or if I have just kind of stolen it from everybody over the last 30 years. But the analogy of the gorilla in the cage, I tell young men, you know, we all have an inner gorilla. And as you grow and mature, you need to restrain that gorilla. There are times to let that gorilla out, like if somebody's trying to kill you and you're in a defensive situation, or if you're playing sports, if you're a football player or something, sure, unleash some of that great passion. But you need to be in complete control. I tell young men, if you have ever come home angry and punched the wall with your fist, that's bad. You have just let the gorilla out of the cage a little bit. And when you let the gorilla out of the cage on instances like that, over a period of time, the gorilla will take charge. And soon enough, the gorilla will come out when it wants to come out, whether you want it to come out or not. If you've
mm-hmm.
ever grabbed a girl, if you've ever thought about slapping your girlfriend, ever even considered it, or if you've ever grabbed her wrist really hard, any of those things, that's the gorilla taking over. And that's unacceptable, and it's violent behavior, and it will only get worse if you don't get control of it now.
Mm-hmm.
And the second part of my message is to young women. I tell young women, and I've had the great opportunity to tell thousands of them in high school, you know, here are the things that are unacceptable in a dating relationship. And I talk about controllers, and I talk about abuse, and I talk about aggressive behavior and aggressive language. I talk about all those things. And I say, if you need to have a picture in your mind of the respect you require of the men you allow in your life. And if you have a guy that's not giving you that respect or is the least bit emotionally or physically abusive to you, you know, walk away from him. Walk away from him and tell him, I'm not going to be your girlfriend anymore. And if that's not good enough, if it still bothers you, call the police. Tell your parents, tell your grandparents, tell whoever you live with, call the police. And you got to be serious about it because we know this about young men. Young men learn to be abusers most often by watching fathers and grandfathers. We know that. You know, we know that the people who grow up to be violent abusers, that's not because they're poor. It's not because of their race. It's not because of their religion. It's not because of any of those things. It's because more often than not, they were raised in that environment. And they were raised to see
right.
that that's acceptable when it's really not. And we know that. And we also know that the only thing that will change a young man's behavior is a significant emotional event. And there's no definition for that. It's different for everybody. Some young men Going to jail one time is a significant emotional event. Some young men having their girlfriend slap them in the face and say, don't ever come back around me again. That's a significant emotional event. But for many men, it is not. And I tell young girls, get away. You have to have the courage to break it off. Have the courage to break it off. Walk away. Tell your parents. Tell your friends. We are not dating anymore. If this guy comes around or calls, call the police. Call the police.
Right.
And some young women get that. Some young women hear that, and they realize, holy cow, I'm in that relationship now. You know, when I spoke
after
to a large
group. After
you
say that, it becomes vivid, yeah, yeah. But what do you say about the women who always have to have, who always have to have somebody on their arm with their peer group? It's not cool not to have a girlfriend or a boyfriend. They don't want to be ostracized and be the only one that doesn't have somebody. And if it's a dysfunctional person, doesn't matter. At least they have someone.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And they don't know the danger. If you don't hear it at home, and I've told many men this, many adult men, we need to tell our sons, our grandsons, our nephews this. They need to hear it from us. This is not acceptable behavior. They need to hear from us. So many young men I see grow up in a household, and they don't ever have anybody tell them, hey, by the way, let me tell you how you need to treat women that you have relationships with. They don't get it at home. They don't get it from their fathers. A lot of men mistakenly think, you know, this is a woman's problem. This is not a man's problem. Come on. It's a woman's problem. I tell men in every presentation, this is a man's problem because we are the ones that are perpetuating this because we're not mentoring and guiding our sons and our grandsons and our nephews.
No, I totally agree with you. But the one thing the component, like maybe it's there when you talk to people, you can talk to them till the cows come home, but if there are no consequences for them with doing this behavior repeatedly or get a slap on the wrist, or they go from one person to another, continue to do this with girlfriend after girlfriend or whatever, what do you see as appropriate consequences, you know, after these type of things with men so it doesn't escalate to murder, Larry?
Well, I think there needs to be some mechanism to identify the behavior, to identify it, to say, whoa, look at this. This guy's down a bad path. And there needs to be some mechanism to pull that person off to the side and say, we need to talk about this. We need to engage in some type of counseling. We need to make sure that you're not down this path that so many men have went down. And we need to explain to you the negative effect it'll have on your life if you don't get a hold of yourself and change your ways right now. In a perfect world, in a perfect society, we would have that mechanism. But frankly,
are you talking about in the schools? Like the guidance counselor, the social worker, the whomever?
Yes. Yes, and even the juvenile justice system, unfortunately, the schools and the juvenile justice system are so overwhelmed. They're so overwhelmed. And they don't and they have limited resources. You know, we're talking about a long-term, expensive, strategic investment, and that's not necessarily what our society is best at, unfortunately.
Right.
But I know that, you know, I see juvenile prosecutors. We deal with the juvenile court here in Franklin County. We have our own juvenile diversion program here in Bexley. And it is tough. And in this age, especially in urban America, many parents are very, very quick to go on the defense for their sons. They're very quick to go on an aggressive defense because they're fearful. They don't trust the system. They're fearful their kids won't get a fair shake. Whatever it might be, they go on the defense. And you just wish you had a mechanism to say, hey, knock it off. You're doing Junior much more harm than you are good. You know, sometimes if young men, when they're juveniles, are held accountable and slapped a little bit, if they're, you know, a little bit of a wake-up call, they can readjust and maybe grow into adults.
Do you have the mechanism? We've got about 4 minutes left of our show, just to give you a benchmark. Have you identified a particular mechanism that you're talking about? And what kind of progress have you seen since you have made these presentations, even locally where you work, have you seen some progress?
Well, some individual cases. Sometimes young men come through our juvenile diversion program here where we can keep tabs on them and we can assign specific things. And we've seen some limited success with that. But unfortunately, on the more serious, the bigger cases where we're forced to turn everything over to the county juvenile system, I can't say that I've honestly seen any great behavior changes in young men that are well down that path.
Right.
And I suspect every chief in urban America would say the same thing.
Right. So you are more like what we like to focus on is being proactive, nipping this in the bud before it escalates, because that's when it escalates to what happened to your sister, it's too late for that person, right? So you have to be proactive beforehand, and that's what Delilah and I and all these different people preach, that, you know, once you have this problem, it doesn't matter what it is, you know, the human trafficking, domestic violence, homicide, you have to be proactive so that you can veer people in a different direction before it gets to that point of escalation and death, right?
Right. That's exactly right. I hope that my presentations and talking to so many young people and so many parents, I hope that maybe I've had some proactive benefit. I know I've affected a few kids, but, you know, the people I touch is such a small number. But we just have to keep trying, right?
Well, yes, definitely. And I know you've made an impression in your area, and I heard wonderful things about your presentation at NOVA. And to have that, you know, national opportunity, you are paying it forward for Laura, and I know she'd be very proud of you. And you know, you are such an enlightening speaker. I'd love to have you back someday on another topic if you'd like, or another aspect of this. For now, what would be your one thing that you would tell the audience if they were in a similar position to do? And then maybe if you'd like to share some contact information, that'd be great as well.
Well, my key point I tell to friends and family and loved ones of potential victims is stay in touch. Don't give up on them. Stay in touch. Whatever you do, just do not give up. Keep extending the love and that hand, and someday the victim will take it. And as far as contact information, I tell people, please know, whatever area you live in, get out your directory, get on the Internet, find out the domestic violence organizations in your city, in your town, in your area. They're out there. They need your money. Send them $5 or $10 if you can. Help them out all you can, but have their phone number, because you never know when your friend is going to call and say, I'm in trouble, I need some help.
Yeah. Do you think the shelters are effective with regard to the scope of the problem these days? I know you've been associated with Choices in the past.
Right. Choices was an incredible organization. Lutheran Social Services has stepped in and helped them with some of their financial problems. And I have finished my time on the board. Shelters help such a limited number of people. There are so many people, so many women living in violence right now that they just live in it. They just decide,
right,
I can't go to the shelter. They just say they succumb to it. We're not reaching those folks. We're not helping them come up with ways to get their life back. Shelters do seem to have a pretty limited effect, but they're critical. It's a critical service.
In the transition, yes, I know. Well, Delilah, do you have some parting comments? And then we're going to have to close out the show.
No, I just think it's been a fantastic show, and thank you, Larry, for all of your wisdom. And especially, you know, I want to get there again and verify, or, you know, validate this out there with our listeners. It's so important to get to our young men. Women can be abusers as well, but as we know, the statistics are the other way. And
right,
I think what you're doing there and exactly what you said is so
wonderful,
very, very needed. You know, boys just don't know what to do with all of that aggression sometimes. And if it's channeled properly, it's a great thing. But if it's not, and, you know, this is where a lot of abusers come from.
Yeah, you're exactly right.
I still agree. And, yeah, and to make the focus, you know, young men, it's such an important component. So I applaud you, and I hope you'll stay in touch with me. I think we can, you know, perhaps we can do something collaborative in the future. And thank you so much for all of the lessons. We will have this available on the archives. And so for that, we're going to have to say good evening. Thank you so much, Chief Reinhardt. And thank you, Delilah. And we'll have to say good evening to my national audience. Until the next episode, the next Saturday of Shattered Lives, okay?